The six Viking colonies on North Atlantic Islands constitute six parallel experiments in establishing societies derived from the same ancestral source. Those six experiments resulted in different outcomes. The Orkney, Shetland, and Faroe colonies have continued to exist for more than 1,000 years, without their survival ever being in serious doubt. The Iceland colony also persisted, but had to overcome poverty and serious political difficulties. The Greenland Norse died out after about 450 years, and the Vinland colony was abandoned within the first decade. The four main environmental variables responsible for the different outcomes appear to be sailing times by ship from Norway and Britain, resistance offered by non-Viking inhabitants, suitability for agriculture, and environmental fragility, especially susceptibility to soil erosion and deforestation. The Orkneys are an island archipelago just off the northern tip of Britain, wrapped around a large sheltered harbor. From the northernmost point of the Scottish mainland to the nearest Orkney island is only 11 miles, and from the Orkneys to Norway barely a 24-hour sail in Viking ships. That made it easy for Norwegian Vikings to invade the Orkneys, to import whatever they needed from Norway or the British Isles, and to ship out their own exports cheaply. Many species of land mammals, including elk, otters, and hares, provided good hunting. Viking invaders quickly subdued the indigenous population, known as the Picts. The Orkneys enjoy a mild climate. Their fertile, heavy soils have been renewed by glaciation and are not at serious risk of erosion. The Vikings conquered the Orkneys around 800 and built up a rich, powerful society that remained for some time an independent Norse kingdom. In 1472, ownership of the Orkneys passed without conquest from Denmark to Scotland. Today, the Orkney descendants of indigenous Picts and Norse invaders remain prosperous farmers, enriched by a terminal for North Sea oil. Some of what I have just said about the Orkneys also applies to the Shetland Islands. They, too, were originally occupied by Pict farmers, conquered by Vikings in the 9th century, ceded to Scotland in 1472, and have recently profited from North Sea oil. Differences are that they are slightly more remote and northerly, windier, have poorer soils, and are less productive agriculturally. Raising sheep for wool has been an economic mainstay, but raising cattle failed and was replaced by increased emphasis on fishing. Next in isolation after the Orkneys and Shetlands were the Faroe Islands, 400 miles west of Norway. Lying 300 miles south of the Arctic Circle, the Faroes enjoy a mild oceanic climate. However, their more northerly location meant a shorter growing season for would-be farmers and herders. Salt spray from the ocean combined with strong winds to prevent the development of forests. The original vegetation consisted of nothing taller than low willows, birches, aspen, and junipers, which were quickly cleared by the first settlers and prevented from regenerating by browsing sheep. In a drier climate, that would have been a recipe for soil erosion, but the Faroes enjoy rain on an average of 280 days each year. The settlers themselves also adopted policies to minimize erosion, such as building walls and terraces to prevent soil loss. Vikings settled the Faroes during the 9th century. They managed to grow some barley, but few or no other crops. Cows, pigs, and goats were abandoned within the first 200 years to prevent overgrazing. Instead, the Faroe economy became focused on raising sheep to export wool, supplemented later by export of salt fish, and today of dried cod, halibut, and farmed salmon. In return for those wool and fish exports, the islanders imported from Norway and Britain the bulk necessities that were lacking or deficient in the Faroe environment, especially huge quantities of wood. The islands became tributary to Norway in the 11th century, passed with Norway to Denmark in 1380, and achieved self-government under Denmark in 1948. The 47,000 inhabitants today still speak a Faroese language, directly derived from Old Norse, and very similar to modern Icelandic. The four elements that form Iceland's environment are volcanic fire, ice, water, and wind. Iceland lies in the North Atlantic Ocean about 600 miles west of Norway, on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, where the American and Eurasian continental plates collide, and where volcanoes periodically rise from the ocean to build up chunks of new land, of which Iceland is the largest. On the average, at least one of Iceland's many volcanoes undergoes a major eruption every decade or two. Besides the volcanoes themselves, Iceland's hot springs and geothermal areas are so numerous that much of the country heats its houses not by burning fossil fuels, but just by tapping volcanic heat. The second element in Iceland's landscape is ice, which forms and remains as ice caps on much of Iceland's interior plateau, because it is at high elevation, just below the Arctic Circle, and hence, cold. Water falling as rain and snow reaches the ocean in glaciers, in rivers that periodically flood, and in occasional spectacular superfloods, when a natural dam of lava or ice across a lake gives way, or when a volcanic eruption under an ice cap suddenly melts a lot of ice. Finally, Iceland is also a very windy place. It is the interaction between these four elements of volcanoes, cold, water, and wind that has made Iceland so susceptible to erosion. When the first Viking settlers reached Iceland, its volcanoes and hot springs were strange sights, but otherwise the landscape looked familiar and encouraging. Almost all of the plants and birds belonged to familiar European species. The lowlands were mostly covered by low birch and willow forest that was easily cleared for pastures. In those cleared locations, in natural low-lying treeless areas such as bogs, and at higher elevations above timberline, the settlers found lush pasture grass, herbs, and moss, ideal for raising the livestock that they had already been raising in Norway and the British Isles. The soil was fertile, in some places up to 50 feet deep. Despite the high-altitude ice caps and the location near the Arctic Circle, the nearby Gulf Stream made the climate in the lowlands mild enough in some years to grow barley in the south. The lakes, rivers, and surrounding seas teemed with fish, seabirds, and ducks, while seals and walruses lived along the coast. But Iceland's apparent similarity to southwestern Norway and Britain was deceptive in three crucial respects. First, Iceland's shorter growing season made agriculture more marginal. Second, the ash that volcanic eruptions periodically ejected over wide areas poisoned fodder for livestock. The biggest set of problems that deceived the settlers involved differences between Iceland's soils and Norway's and Britain's soils. The settlers could not appreciate those differences partly because some of them are subtle, but also because one of those differences was invisible at first sight and would take years to appreciate. Namely, that Iceland's soils form more slowly and erode much more quickly than those of Norway and Britain. Unfortunately, while Iceland's soils and dense woodlands were impressive to the eye, they had accumulated very slowly. What is it that makes Iceland's soils so fragile and slow to form? A major reason has to do with their origin. In Iceland, frequent eruptions of volcanoes throw clouds of fine ash into the air. That ash includes light particles that strong winds proceed to carry over much of the country, resulting in the formation of an ash layer that can be as light as talcum powder. On that rich, fertile ash, vegetation eventually grows up, covering the ash and protecting it from erosion. But when that vegetation is removed, by grazing or by farmers burning it, the ash becomes exposed again. Because the ash was light enough to be carried by the wind in the first place, it is also light enough to be carried by the wind again. In addition to that wind erosion, Iceland's locally heavy rains and frequent floods also remove the exposed ash by water erosion, especially on steep slopes. Iceland's colonization began in earnest around the year 870 and virtually ended by the year 930, when almost all land suitable for farming had been settled or claimed. Most settlers came directly from western Norway, the remainder being Vikings who had already emigrated to the British Isles and married Celtic wives. Those settlers tried to recreate a herding economy similar to the lifestyle that they had known, and based on the same five barnyard animals, among which sheep eventually became by far the most numerous. Sheep milk was made into butter, cheese, and an Icelandic specialty called skyr, which is like a delicious thick yogurt. To make up the rest of their diet, Icelanders relied on wild game and fish. The breeding walrus colonies were quickly exterminated, and the breeding seabirds became depleted, leaving hunters to shift attention to seals. Eventually, the main source of wild protein became fish. Both the abundant trout, salmon, and char in lakes and rivers, and the abundant cod and haddock along the coast. Those cod and haddock were crucial in enabling Icelanders to survive the hard centuries of the Little Ice Age and in driving Iceland's economy today. At the time that settlement began, one quarter of the island's area was forested. About 80% of that original woodland was cleared within the first few decades, and 96% as of modern times, thus leaving only 1% of Iceland's area still forested. Once the original trees had been removed, grazing by sheep prevented seedlings from regenerating. Iceland's highlands above the tree line, supporting natural grassland on fertile, shallow soil, were particularly attractive to the settlers, who didn't even have to clear trees there in order to create pastures. But the highlands were more fragile than the lowlands. Once the natural carpet of grassland had been cleared or browsed off, the soil was exposed to wind erosion. In addition, water running downhill could start to erode gullies into the now bare soil. But as a gully developed and as the water table dropped from the level of the top of the gully to the bottom, the soil dried out and became even more subject to wind erosion. Within a short time after settlement, the highlands became stripped of soil as well as of vegetation. The former grasslands of Iceland's interior became the desert that one sees today, and then large eroded areas started to develop in the lowlands as well. When the settlers finally realized what was happening, they did take corrective action. They stopped throwing away big pieces of wood, stopped keeping ecologically destructive pigs and goats, and abandoned much of the highlands. Groups of neighboring farms cooperated in jointly making decisions critical for preventing erosion, such as the decision about when in the late spring the grass growth warranted taking the sheep up to communally owned high-altitude mountain pastures for the summer, and when in the fall to bring the sheep back down. Iceland's political history from 870 onwards can be quickly summarized. For several centuries it was self-governing, until fighting between chiefs resulted in many killings of people and burnings of farms in the first half of the 13th century. In 1262, Icelanders invited Norway's king to govern them, reasoning that a distant king could not possibly plunge their land into such disorder as their own chiefs. The thrones of Denmark, Sweden, and Norway were unified in 1397. In 1874, Iceland achieved some self-government, home rule in 1904, and full independence from Denmark in 1944. Beginning in the late Middle Ages, Iceland's economy was stimulated by the rise of trade in dried cod. Because Iceland itself lacked big trees good for shipbuilding, those fish were caught and exported by ships belonging to an assortment of foreigners. In the early 1900s, Iceland at last began to develop a fleet of its own and underwent an explosion of industrial-scale fishing. By 1950, more than 90% of Iceland's total exports were marine products. Already in 1923, Iceland's urban population overtook its rural population in numbers. Iceland is now the most urbanized Scandinavian country, with half its population in the capital of Reykjavik alone. Today, thanks to its abundance of fish, geothermal power, and hydroelectric power from all its rivers, Europe's former poorest country has become one of the world's richest countries on a per capita basis. A great success story. However, Iceland is ecologically the most heavily damaged country in Europe. The government today is very concerned about Iceland's historical curses of soil erosion and sheep overgrazing, which played such a large role in their country's long impoverishment. Many studies of medieval Icelandic settlements and erosion patterns are now underway. When one of my archaeologist friends approached the Icelandic government and began to deliver the usual lengthy justification required in other countries, the government's response was, "Yes, of course we realize that understanding medieval soil erosion will help us understand our present problem. Here is the money. Go do your study." The brief existence of the most remote Viking North Atlantic colony, Vinland, is a separate story, fascinating in its own right. The coast of northeastern North America, reached by the Vikings, lies thousands of miles from Norway, far beyond direct reach of Viking ships. Instead, all Viking ships destined for North America sailed from Greenland. To sail from Greenland to Vinland and then return within the summer sailing season would have left little time for exploring Vinland. Hence, the Vikings established a base camp on Newfoundland, where they could remain for the winter, so as to be able to spend the entire subsequent summer exploring. The known Vinland voyages were organized in Greenland by two sons, a daughter and a daughter-in-law of Eric the Red, who had founded the Greenland colony in 984. Their motive was to reconnoiter the land, in order to see what products it offered, and to gauge its suitability for settlement. We have two sources of information about the Vikings' attempt to settle North America: written accounts and archaeological excavations. The written accounts consist mainly of two sagas describing the initial Vinland voyages of discovery and exploration, transmitted orally for several centuries and finally written down in Iceland during the 1200s. In the absence of independent confirming evidence, scholars tended to dismiss the sagas as fiction and to doubt that the Vikings ever reached the New World, until archaeologists located the Vikings' Newfoundland base camp in 1961. The saga accounts of Vinland are now recognized to be the oldest written descriptions of North America, although scholars still debate the accuracy of their details. They are contained in two separate manuscripts, the Greenlander's Saga and Eric the Red Saga, which are in broad agreement, but have many differences of finer points. They describe up to five separate voyages from Greenland to Vinland within the short span of barely a decade, each voyage involving only a single ship, except that the last voyage used either two or three ships. Despite much searching by archaeologists, only a single Viking camp has been identified and excavated, at Lanso Meadows on the northwest coast of Newfoundland. Radiocarbon dating indicated that the camp was occupied around AD 1000. The site consists of the remains of eight buildings, including three residential halls large enough to hold 80 people, an iron smithy, a carpenter's shop, and boat repair shops, but no farm buildings or farm implements. The sagas describe Vinland as rich in prized resources lacking in Greenland. Yet despite the valuable shiploads of timber, grapes, and animal furs that the Vinland voyagers brought back to Greenland, the voyages were discontinued, and the Lanso Meadows camp was abandoned. The Norse left nothing of value. Objects recovered were confined to small items that had probably been discarded or else dropped and lost, such as 99 broken iron nails, a single hole nail, a bronze pin, a whetstone, a spindle, one glass bead, and a knitting needle. Evidently, the site was not abandoned hastily, but as part of a planned permanent evacuation back to Greenland. Why did the Norse give up on Vinland, land of plenty? The sagas offer a simple answer to that question. The large population of hostile Indians with whom the Vikings failed to establish good relations. According to the sagas, the first Indians that the Vikings met were a group of nine, of whom they killed eight, while the ninth fled. Not surprisingly, the Indians came back in a fleet of small boats, shot arrows at the Norse, and killed their leader, Eric the Red's son, Torvald. The next group of Norse voyagers did manage to establish a trade with local Indians, until one Viking killed an Indian trying to steal weapons. In the ensuing battle, many Indians were killed before fleeing, but that was enough to convince the Norse of the chronic problems that they would face. For our purposes, the most important thing about the failure of the Vinland colony within 10 years is that it was in part a greatly speeded-up preview of the failure that overtook the Greenland colony after 450 years. Norse Greenland survived much longer because it was closer to Norway and because hostile natives did not make their appearance for the first few centuries. But Greenland shared, albeit in less extreme form, Vinland's twin problems of isolation and Norse inability to establish good relations with Native Americans. If it had not been for Native Americans, the Greenlanders might have survived their ecological problems, and the Vinland settlers might have persisted. In that case, Vinland might have undergone a population explosion, and I might now be writing this book in an Old Norse-based language rather than in English. My initial impression of Greenland was that its name was a cruel misnomer. As my airplane approached Greenland's east coast, the first thing visible after the dark blue ocean was a vast area of brilliant white stretching out of sight, the world's largest ice cap outside Antarctica. Greenland's shores rise steeply to an ice-covered high plateau covering most of the island. For hundreds of miles, our plane flew over this white expanse, where the sole other color visible was the black of bare stone mountains rising out of that ocean of ice. Only as our plane descended towards the west coast did I spot two other colors in a thin border outlining the ice sheet, combining brown areas of bare gravel with faint green areas of moss or lichens. But when I landed at southern Greenland's main airport of Nassauswak and crossed the iceberg-strewn fjord to Brattahlid, the site that Erik the Red chose for his own farm, I discovered, to my surprise, that the name Greenland might have been bestowed honestly. Exhausted by my long flight from Los Angeles, I set out to stroll among the Norse ruins but was soon ready for a nap. Fortunately, the ruins lay amidst lush meadows of soft grass over a foot high, growing up out of thick moss, and dotted with abundant yellow buttercups, dandelions, bluebells, white asters, and pink willow herbs. I fell into a deep sleep in the softest and most beautiful natural bed imaginable. While 99% of the island is indeed uninhabitable, there are green areas deep inside two fjord systems on the southwest coast. The fjords penetrate far inland, such that their heads are remote from the cold ocean currents, icebergs, salt spray, and wind that suppress growth of vegetation along Greenland's outer coast. Here and there along the mostly steep-sided fjords are patches of flatter terrain with luxuriant pastures, including the one in which I took a nap. For nearly 500 years, between 984 and sometime in the 1400s, those two fjord systems supported European civilization's most remote outpost, where Scandinavians built churches, wrote in Latin and Old Norse, wielded iron tools, herded farm animals, followed the latest European fashions, and finally vanished. The Vikings shared Greenland with another people, the Inuit. The Vikings disappeared, but the Inuit survived. Why did those medieval Scandinavians ultimately fail to master Greenland's problems, while the Inuit succeeded? A favorite theory has been climatic cooling. Other single-factor theories have included extermination of the Norse by the Inuit, abandonment of the Norse by mainland Europeans, environmental damage, and a hopelessly conservative outlook. In fact, the Greenland Norse extinction is a richly instructive case precisely because it involves major contributions of all five of the explanatory factors discussed in the introduction to this book. It is a rich case not only in reality, but also in our available information about it, because the Norse left written accounts of Greenland. Nevertheless, major questions remain about even this most richly documented pre-industrial collapse. What was the environment in which the Greenland Norse colonies arose, thrived, and fell? The Norse lived in two settlements on Greenland's west coast below the Arctic Circle, around latitude 61 and 64 degrees north. That's south of most of Iceland, and comparable to the latitudes on Norway's west coast. But Greenland is colder than either Iceland or Norway, because the latter are bathed by the warm Gulf Stream flowing up from the south, whereas Greenland's west coast is bathed by the cold West Greenland Current flowing down from the Arctic. As a result, the weather can be summed up in four words: cold, variable, windy, and foggy. Mean summer temperatures today at the settlements are around 42 degrees Fahrenheit on the outer coast, 50 degrees in the interiors of the fjords. Remember that that's only for the warmest months of the year. In addition, strong, dry winds frequently blow down from Greenland's ice cap, bringing drift ice from the north, blocking the fjords with icebergs even during the summer, and causing dense fogs. I was told the large short-term climate fluctuations that I encountered during my summer visit to Greenland, including heavy rain, strong winds, and fog, often made it impossible to travel by boat. But boats are the main means of transport in Greenland, because the coast is so deeply indented with branching fjords. Even today, there are no roads connecting Greenland's main population centers. Weather changes from year to year are illustrated by recent experience of hay yields on sheep farms that resumed operation in Greenland beginning in the 1920s. Wetter years yield more growth of vegetation, which generally is good news. However, if too much rain falls during the harvest season, yields decrease because the hay is hard to dry. A cold summer is bad because it decreases hay growth. A long winter is bad because it means that animals have to be kept in barns for more months and require more hay. And a summer with much drift ice coming down from the north is bad because it results in dense summer fogs that are bad for hay growth. Year-to-year weather differences like those making life dicey for modern Greenland sheep farmers must have made it dicey for the medieval Norse as well. Those are the climate changes that one can observe in Greenland today. How can one learn about past climate? First, because the Greenland Norse were literate, it would have been nice if they had bothered to leave some accounts of Greenland's weather. Unfortunately, they didn't. For Iceland, though, we have many accounts of weather in different years. This information is of some use for understanding the climate in Greenland, because a cold decade in Iceland tends to be cold in Greenland as well, though the agreement isn't perfect. Our second source of information about past Greenland climates consists of pollen samples from cores drilled into lakes and bogs by palynologists. As past climates became colder in Greenland, palynologists find pollen shifting from that of warmth-demanding trees to that of cold-tolerant grasses and sedges. But that same shift in pollen may also mean that the Norse were cutting down trees. By far, our most detailed information about Greenland climates in the past comes from ice cores. Snow that falls each year on Greenland's ice cap becomes compressed by the weight of later years of snow into ice. The warmer the temperature at which snow forms, the higher is the proportion of oxygen 18 in the snow's oxygen. Hence, each year's summer snow is higher in its proportion of oxygen 18 than the same year's winter snow. For the same reason, snow oxygen 18 in a given month of a warm year is higher than in the same month of a cold year. Thus, as you drill down through the Greenland ice cap, something that scientists have now done down to a depth of almost 2 miles, and measure the oxygen 18 proportion as a function of depth, the ice core tells us each year's summer temperature and each year's winter temperature. As a bonus, the thickness of the ice layer tells us the amount of precipitation that fell during that year. In short, we can reconstruct past Greenland climates on a year-to-year basis. What have we thereby learned? Between 800 and 1300, ice cores tell us that the climate in Greenland was relatively mild, similar to Greenland's weather today, or even slightly warmer. Thus, the Norse reached Greenland during a period good for growing hay and pasturing animals. Around 1300, though, the climate in the North Atlantic began to get cooler and more variable from year to year, ushering in a cold period termed the Little Ice Age that lasted into the 1800s. By around 1420, the Little Ice Age was in full swing, and the increased summer drift ice between Greenland, Iceland, and Norway ended ship communication between the Greenland Norse and the outside world. Those cold conditions were tolerable or even beneficial for the Inuit, who could hunt ringed seals, but were bad news for the Norse, who depended on growing hay. To complete our consideration of Greenland's environment, let's mention its native plants and animals. The best developed vegetation is confined to areas of mild climate in the long inner fjords of the western and eastern settlements on Greenland's southwest coast. There, vegetation in areas not grazed by livestock varies by location. At higher elevations and in the outer fjords, the vegetation is dominated by sedges, which are shorter than grasses and have lower nutritional value to grazing animals. Less hostile inland sites mostly support a heath vegetation of dwarf shrubs. The best inland sites carry an open woodland of dwarf birch and willows, with some junipers and alders, and the very best sites with birches up to 30 feet tall. In areas grazed today by sheep and horses, the vegetation presents a different picture, and would have in Norse times as well. Moist meadows on gentle slopes have lush grass up to 1 foot high with many flowers. Patches of dwarf willow and birch grazed down by sheep reach only 1.5 feet in height. Drier, more sloping and exposed fields carry grasses or dwarf willow up to only 1 inch high. As for Greenland's wild animals, the ones potentially most important to the Norse and Inuit were land and sea mammals, and birds, fish, and marine invertebrates. Greenland's sole native large terrestrial herbivore in the former Norse areas is the caribou. Polar bears and wolves were virtually confined in Greenland to areas north of the Norse settlements. Smaller game animals included hares, foxes, land birds, freshwater birds, and seabirds. The most important marine mammals were seals of 6 different species. Various species of whales occur along the coast and were successfully hunted by the Inuit, but not by the Norse. Fish abounded in rivers, lakes, and oceans, while shrimp and mussels were the most valuable edible marine invertebrates. According to sagas and medieval histories, around the year 980, a hot-blooded Norwegian known as Erik the Red was charged with murder and forced to leave for Iceland, where he soon killed a few more people and was chased out to another part of Iceland. Having ended up there, too, in a quarrel and having killed still more people, he was this time exiled from Iceland for 3 years, beginning around 982. Erik remembered that many decades earlier, one Gunnbjorn Olsen had been blown off course while sailing for Iceland and had spotted some barren small islands which we now know lay just off Greenland's southeast coast. Erik sailed for those islands to try his luck, spent the next 3 years exploring much of the Greenland coast, and discovered good pasture land inside the deep fjords. On his return to Iceland, he lost yet another fight, impelling him to lead a fleet of 25 ships to settle the newly explored land that he shrewdly named Greenland. News brought back to Iceland of the fine homesteads available for the asking in Greenland motivated 3 more fleets of settlers to sail from Iceland during the next decade. As a result, by 1000, virtually all the land suitable for farms in both western and eastern settlements had been occupied, yielding an eventual total Norse population estimated at around 5,000, about 1,000 people at western settlement, 4,000 at eastern settlement. Greenland settlers started out with aspirations based on the mix of livestock maintained by prosperous Norwegian chiefs. Lots of cows and pigs, fewer sheep, and still fewer goats, plus some horses, ducks, and geese. As gauged by counts of animal bones identified in radiocarbon-dated Greenland garbage middens, it quickly turned out that that mix was not well suited to Greenland's colder conditions. Barnyard ducks and geese dropped out immediately. Although Vikings prized pork above all other meats, pigs proved terribly destructive in lightly wooded Greenland. Within a short time, they were virtually eliminated. Archaeological finds of pack saddles and sledges show that horses were kept as work animals, but there was a Christian religious ban against eating them, so their bones rarely ended up in the garbage. Cows required far more effort than sheep or goats because they could find grass and pastures only during the 3 snow-free summer months. For the rest of the year, they had to be kept in barns and fed on hay. Instead, the staple food-producing animals in Greenland became hardy breeds of sheep and goats. Unlike cows, they can dig down under snow to find grass for themselves in the winter. In Greenland today, sheep can be kept outdoors for 9 months per year. Numbers of sheep plus goats started off barely equal to cow numbers, and then rose with time to as many as 8 sheep or goats for every cow. As between sheep and goats, relative numbers shifted with time, until goat numbers rival those of sheep. That's because goats can digest the tough twigs, shrubs, and dwarf trees prevalent in poor Greenland pastures. The ruins of the barns in which the Greenland Norse kept their cows for 9 months per year are still visible. They consisted of long, narrow buildings with stone and turf walls several yards thick to keep the barn warm inside during the winter. Each cow was kept in its own rectangular stall. From the size of the stalls, and of course from excavated skeletons of the cows themselves, one can calculate that Greenland cows were the smallest known in the modern world, not more than 4 feet high at the shoulder. During the winter, they remained in their stalls, where the dung accumulated as a rising tide around them until the spring, when the sea of dung was shoveled outside. During the winter, the cows were fed on harvested hay, but if its quantities weren't sufficient, it had to be supplemented with seaweed. The cows evidently didn't like the seaweed, so that farm laborers had to live in the barn and perhaps force-feed the cows, which gradually became smaller and weaker. Around May, when the snow started to melt and new grass came up, the cows could at last be brought out of doors to start grazing, but by then they were so weak that they had to be carried. Greenland cows, sheep, and goats were used mainly for milking rather than for meat. After the animals gave birth in May or June, they yielded milk just during the few summer months. The Norse then turned the milk into cheese, butter, and skyr, which they stored in huge barrels kept cold by being placed either in mountain streams or in turf houses, and they ate those dairy products throughout the winter. The goats were also kept for their hair, and the sheep for their wool, which was of exceptionally high quality because sheep in cold climates produce wool that is naturally waterproof. It took several tons of hay to maintain a cow throughout an average Greenland winter. Hence, the main occupation of most Greenland Norse during the late summer had to be cutting, drying, and storing hay. The hay quantities determined how many animals could be fed throughout the following winter, but that depended on the duration of that winter, which could not be predicted exactly in advance. Hence, each September, the Norse had to make the agonizing decision of how many of their livestock to cull. If they killed too many, they would end up in May with uneaten hay and just a small herd. But if they killed too few animals, they might find themselves running out of hay before May and risk the whole herd starving. Dairy products alone were not enough to feed the 5,000 Norse inhabitants of Greenland. Gardening was of little use in making up that resulting deficit. Instead, the main other component of the Greenland Norse diet was meat of wild animals, especially caribou and seals. Caribou teeth found in Norse garbage middens show that the animals were hunted in the fall, probably by bow and arrow in communal drives with dogs. The middens also had bones of big elk hounds. The three main seal species hunted were the common seal, alias harbor seal, which is resident all year round and comes out on beaches and inner fjords to bear its pups in the spring, at which time it would have been easy to net from boats or kill by clubbing, and the migratory harp seal and hooded seal, both of which arrive in Greenland around May in large herds along the sea coast. The May arrival of seals was critical to Norse survival, because at that time of year, the stocks of stored dairy products and caribou meat would be running out, but the livestock had not yet given birth and were not yet producing milk. By means of measurements of bone composition, one can calculate the ratio of seafood to land-grown food that the human or animal had consumed over the course of a lifetime. As applied to Norse skeletons recovered from Greenland cemeteries, this method shows that the percentage of seafood, mostly seals, consumed in eastern settlement at the time of its founding was only 20%, but rose to 80% during the later years of Norse survival, presumably because their ability to produce hay to feed livestock had declined, and also because the increased human population needed more food than their livestock could provide. Apart from that heavy reliance on seals and caribou, the Norse obtained minor amounts of wild meat from small mammals, seabirds, beds of mussels, and whales. The latter probably just consisted of the occasional stranded animal. Norse sites contain no harpoons or other whale-hunting equipment. All meat not consumed immediately would have been dried in storage buildings called skemmer, built of uncemented stones for the wind to whistle through and dry out the meat, and located on windy sites like tops of ridges. Conspicuously nearly absent from Norse archaeological sites are fish. Fish bones account for much less than 0.1% of animal bones recovered at Greenland Norse archaeological sites, compared to between 50 and 95% at most contemporary Iceland, northern Norway, and Shetland sites. This paucity of fish bones is incredible when one considers how abundant fish are in Greenland and how saltwater fish are by far the largest export of modern Greenland. Every archaeologist who comes to excavate in Greenland refuses initially to believe the incredible claim that the Greenland Norse didn't eat fish and starts out with his or her own idea about where all those missing fish bones might be hiding. Could the Norse have strictly confined their munching on fish to within a few feet of the shoreline, at sites now underwater because of land subsidence? Could they have faithfully saved all their fish bones for fertilizer, fuel, or feeding to cows? Could their dogs have run off with those fish carcasses and dropped the fish bones in fields chosen with foresight to be ones where future archaeologists would rarely bother to dig? The trouble with all those excuses for the lack of fish bones at Greenland Norse sites is that they would apply equally well to Greenland Inuit sites, where fish bones prove instead to be abundant. Nor do these excuses explain why Greenland Norse sites contain almost no fish hooks, fish line sinkers, or net sinkers. I prefer instead to take the facts at face value. Even though Greenland's Norse originated from a fish-eating society, they may have developed a taboo against eating fish. Every society has its own arbitrary food taboos. By far, the highest proportion of those taboos involves meat and fish. They are much more likely than plant foods to give us food poisoning or parasites if we eat them. That's especially likely to happen in Iceland and Scandinavia, whose people employ many fermentation methods for long-term preservation of smelly, non-Scandinavians would say rotting, fish, including methods using deadly botulism-causing bacteria. Perhaps Eric the Red got an awful case of food poisoning from eating fish. On his recovery, he would have told everybody how bad fish is for you, and how we Greenlanders are a clean, proud people who would never stoop to the unhealthy habits of those desperate, grubby Icelanders and Norwegians. Greenland's marginality for raising livestock meant that the Greenland Norse had to develop a complex, integrated economy in order to make ends meet. That integration involved both time and space. Different activities were scheduled at different seasons, and different farms specialized in producing different things to share with other farms. To understand the seasonal schedule, let's begin in the spring. In late May and early June came the brief but crucial season of seal hunting. The summer months of June through August were an especially busy season, when the livestock were brought out to pastures to graze. Livestock were yielding milk to turn into storable dairy products. Men set out in boats for Labrador to cut timber. Other boats headed north to hunt walruses, and cargo boats arrived from Iceland or Europe for trading. August and early September were hectic weeks of cutting, drying, and storing hay, just before the weeks in September when the cows were led back to barns and the sheep and goats were brought nearer to shelter. September and October were the season of the caribou hunt, while the winter months from November to April were a time to tend the animals in barns and shelters, to weave, to build and repair with wood, to process the tusks of walrus killed during the summer, and to pray that the food, the hay, and the fuel for heating and cooking didn't run out before the winter's end. Besides that economic integration over time, integration over space was also necessary, because not even the richest Greenland farm was self-sufficient in everything required to survive through the year. That integration involved transfers between outer and inner fjords, between upland and lowland farms, between western and eastern settlement, and between rich and poor farms. For instance, while the best pastures were in the lowlands, the caribou hunt took place at upland farms, while the seal hunt was concentrated in outer fjords. Because western settlement lies 300 miles north of eastern settlement, its hay production per acre was barely one-third that of eastern settlement. However, western settlement was closer to the hunting grounds for walruses and polar bears that were Greenland's chief export to Europe. Thus, western settlement, although much smaller than eastern settlement, was crucial to the Norse economy. Integration of poorer with richer farms was necessary because hay production and grass growth depend especially on a combination of two factors, temperature and hours of sunlight. In a good year, the best farms produce big surpluses of hay and livestock, while small, poor farms produce smaller surpluses. In a bad year, the best farms might still have been left with some surplus, but poorer farms might have found themselves with not even enough hay to feed all their animals through the winter. Hence, they would have had to cull some animals in the fall, and might at worst have had no animals left alive in the spring. The result was that the best farms subsidized poor farms in bad years by lending them livestock in the spring so that the poor farms could rebuild their herds. The complexly integrated economy that I have described, based on raising livestock, hunting on land, and hunting in the fjords, enabled the Greenland Norse to survive. But that economy also hints at a possible reason for the Greenlanders' eventual demise, because it was vulnerable to failure of any of those components. The Norse could cope with livestock losses from one bad summer or bad winter, provided that it was followed by a series of good years. More dangerous was a decade with several bad years, or a summer of low hay production, followed by a long, snowy winter, in combination with a crash in seal numbers, or anything impeding spring access to the outer fjords. As we shall see, that was what actually happened at Western Settlement. Five adjectives characterize Greenland Norse society: communal, violent, hierarchical, conservative, and Eurocentric. All of those features were carried over from the ancestral Icelandic and Norwegian societies. but became expressed to an extreme degree in Greenland. To begin with, Greenland's Norse population of about 5,000 lived on 250 farms, with an average of 20 people per farm, organized in turn into communities centered on 14 main churches, with an average of about 20 farms per church. Norse Greenland was a strongly communal society, in which one person could not go off, make a living by himself or herself, and hope to survive. Every piece of the few useful patches of land in the western and eastern settlements was owned either by some individual farm or communally by a group of farms, which thereby held the rights to all of that land's resources. The result was a tightly controlled society, in which the few chiefs of the richest farms could prevent anyone else from doing something that seemed to threaten their interests, including anyone experimenting with innovations that did not promise to help the chiefs. Also carried to Greenland along with this communality was a strong violent streak. The church cemetery at Bretallet includes, in addition to many individual graves with neatly placed whole skeletons, a mass grave dating from the earliest phase of the Greenland colony, and containing the disarticulated bones of 13 adult men and 1 9-year-old child, probably a clan party that lost a feud. 5 of those skeletons bear skull wounds inflicted by a sharp instrument, presumably an axe or sword. Another male skeleton of the same churchyard has a knife blade between the ribs. 2 female skeletons from Sanus Cemetery with similar cut wounds of the skull testified that women as well as men could die in feuds. The Greenland Norse also carried over from Iceland and Norway a sharply stratified, hierarchically organized social organization, such that a small number of chiefs dominated owners of small farms, tenants who didn't even own their own farms, and initially, slaves. Within the first century or two of the Greenland colony, slavery disappeared, and the slaves became freed men. However, the number of independent farmers probably decreased with time as they were forced into becoming tenants of the chiefs. Those forces consisted of climate fluctuations, drawing poor farmers and bears into debt to farmers who lent them hay and livestock, and who could eventually close on them. Viking Greenland was a conservative society resistant to change. The ultimate reason behind that conservative outlook may have been that they found themselves in a very difficult environment. The remaining adjective that characterizes Greenland Norse society is Eurocentric. From Europe, the Greenlanders received material trade goods, but even more important were non-material imports, identity as Christians and as Europeans. Let us consider first the material trade. What trade items were imported into Greenland, and with what exports did the Greenlanders pay for those imports? For medieval sailing ships, the voyage to Greenland from Norway took a week or more and was dangerous. Hence, the Greenlanders were visited by at most a couple of ships a year, and sometimes only one every few years. In addition, the capacities of European cargo ships were small. Estimates work out to about 7 pounds of cargo per person per year, on the average. Most Greenlanders receive much less than that average, because much of that arriving cargo capacity was devoted to materials for churches and luxuries for the elite. Hence, imports could only be valuable items occupying little space. Our 2 sources of information about Greenland's imports are lists in Norwegian records and items of European origin found in Greenland archaeological sites. They included especially 3 necessities: iron that the Greenlanders were hard-pressed to produce for themselves, good lumber for buildings and furniture, and tar as a lubricant and wood preservative. As for non-economic imports, many were for the church, including church bells, stained glass windows, bronze candlesticks, communion wine, linen, silk, silver, and churchmen's robes and jewelry. Among secular luxuries found in archaeological sites at farmhouses were pewter, pottery, and glass beads and buttons. Small volume luxury food imports probably included honey to ferment into mead, plus salt as a preservative. In exchange for those imports, the same consideration of limited ship cargo capacity would have prevented Greenlanders from exporting bulk fish, as did medieval Iceland, even if Greenlanders had been willing to fish. Instead, Greenland's exports, too, had to be things of low volume and high value. They included skins of goats, cattle, and seals, of which medieval Europe required large quantities to make leather clothes, shoes, and belts. Like Iceland, Greenland exported wool cloth that was valued for being water repellent. But Greenland's most prized exports were five products derived from Arctic animals: ivory from walrus tusks, walrus hide, valued because it yielded the strongest rope for ships, live polar bears or their hides as a spectacular status symbol, tusks of the narwhal, a small whale, known then in Europe as unicorn horns, and live gerfalcons, the world's largest falcon. Walrus tusks became the only ivory available in medieval Europe for carving after Muslims gained control of the Mediterranean, thereby cutting off supplies of elephant ivory. Walruses and polar bears were virtually confined to latitudes far to the north of the two Norse settlements, in an area called the Nordseta, the northern hunting ground, which began several hundred miles beyond western settlement. Hence, each summer, the Greenlanders sent out hunting parties in small, open, six-oared rowboats with sails, which hold up to a ton and a half of cargo. Hunters set off in June after the peak of the harp seal hunt and returned at the end of August. In such small boats, they obviously could not carry the carcasses of hundreds of walruses and polar bears. Instead, the animals were butchered on the spot, and only the walrus jaws with the tusks and the bear skins with the paws, plus the occasional live captive bear, were brought home. Also brought home was the baculum of male walruses, a bone about 1 foot long that forms the core of the walrus penis, because it proved to be of just the right size and shape to make into an axe handle or a hook. The Nordseta hunt was dangerous and expensive in many ways. To begin with, imagine yourself equipped with just a lance, bow and arrow, or club trying to kill a huge enraged walrus or bear before it could kill you. Please also imagine spending several weeks in a small rowboat shared with a live, trussed-up polar bear. The boat journey itself along the cold, stormy coast of West Greenland exposed hunters to risk of death from shipwreck or exposure. Apart from those dangers, the trip constituted expensive use of boats, manpower, and summertime for people short of all three. Much of what the Greenlanders obtained in return for those walrus tusks and bearskins was just luxury goods for churches and chiefs. From our perspective today, we can't help thinking of more important uses that the Greenlanders could have made of those boats and man-time. From the Greenlanders' perspective, though, the hunt must have brought great prestige to the individual hunters, and it maintained for the whole society the psychologically vital contact with Europe. By the mid-1200s, there were often periods of several years in which no ship at all visited Greenland. In 1257, Norway's King Håkon Håkonsson, as part of his effort to assert his authority over all of the Norse Atlantic island societies, sent three commissioners to Greenland to persuade the hitherto independent Greenlanders to acknowledge his sovereignty and pay tribute. Although the details of the resulting agreement have not been preserved, some documents suggest that Greenland's acceptance of Norwegian sovereignty was in return for the king's promise to dispatch two ships each year. Thereafter, Greenland's trade became a Norwegian royal monopoly. At least as important as Europe's material exports to Greenland were its psychological exports of Christian identity and European identity. Those two identities may explain why the Greenlanders acted in ways that ultimately cost them their lives, but that for many centuries enabled them to maintain a functioning society under the most difficult conditions faced by any medieval Europeans. Greenland converted to Christianity around 1000, at the same time as the conversions of Iceland and the other Viking Atlantic colonies, and of Norway itself. For more than a century, the Greenland churches remained small structures, built of turf, mainly on the largest farms. But Greenland had no resident bishop, whose presence was required for performing confirmations and for a church to be considered consecrated. Hence, around 1118, Einar Saccesson was sent to Norway in order to persuade its king to provide Greenland with a bishop. As inducements, Einar took along to give the king a large supply of ivory, walrus hides, and, best of all, a live polar bear. That did the trick. The king persuaded Bishop Arnold to become Greenland's first resident bishop, to be followed by about nine others over the succeeding centuries. Without exception, All were born and educated in Europe and came to Greenland only upon their appointment as bishop. Not surprisingly, they looked to Europe for their models, preferred beef over seal meat, and directed resources of Greenland society to the Norðsetta hunt that enabled them to buy wine and vestments for themselves and stained glass windows for their churches. A big construction program of churches followed Arnold's appointment and continued to around 1300 when the lovely church at Kvalsi was erected as one of the last. Greenland's ecclesiastical establishment came to consist of one cathedral, about 13 large parish churches, many smaller churches, and even a monastery and a nunnery. While most of the churches were built with stone lower walls and turf upper walls, Kvalsi Church and at least three others had walls entirely of stone. These big churches were all out of proportion to the size of the tiny society that erected and supported them. For instance, St. Nicholas's Cathedral at Gardar was as large as either of the two cathedrals of Iceland, whose population was 10 times that of Greenland. Gardar Cathedral and the other Greenland churches must have consumed horrifyingly large amounts of scarce timber to support their walls and roofs. Imported church paraphernalia were also expensive to Greenlanders because they were ultimately bought with the sweat and blood of Norðsetta hunters and competed for the limited cargo space on arriving ships. Recurrent expenses that their churches cost the Greenlanders were an annual tithe paid to Rome and additional crusade tithes levied on all Christians. That the church was able to extract such tithes and complete such building programs testifies to the authority it commanded in Greenland. Besides that specific identity as Christians, Greenlanders maintain their European identity in many other ways. Over the centuries of their colony's existence, the Greenlanders followed European customs in detail. The excellent preservation of garments wrapped around the corpses buried in the permafrost at Herjolfsnes churchyard from the final decades of the colony's existence show us that the Greenland clothes followed smart European fashions. Those clothes included, for women, a long, low-necked gown with a narrow waist. For men, a sporty coat called a hooplanda, which was a long, loose outer garment held in by a belt at the waist and with loose sleeves up which the wind could whistle, jackets buttoned up the front, and tall cylindrical caps. These adoptions of European styles carry the unconscious message, "We are Europeans, we are Christians. God forbid that anyone could confuse us with the Inuit." The insistence on "we are Europeans" becomes serious when it leads to stubbornly maintaining cows in Greenland's climate, diverting manpower from the summer hay harvest to the Norðsetta hunt, refusing to adopt useful features of Inuit technology, and starving to death as a result. To us in our secular modern society, the predicament in which the Greenlanders found themselves is difficult to fathom. To them, however, concerned with their social survival as much as with their biological survival, it was out of the question to invest less in churches, to imitate or intermarry with the Inuit, and thereby to face an eternity in hell just in order to survive another winter on Earth. The Norse initially prospered in Greenland due to a fortunate set of circumstances surrounding their arrival. They had the good luck to discover a virgin landscape that was suitable for use as pasture. They arrived at a time of relatively mild climate, when hay production was sufficient in most years, when the sea lanes to Europe were free of ice, when there was European demand for walrus ivory, and when there were no Native Americans anywhere near the Norse settlements or hunting grounds. All of those initial advantages gradually turned against the Norse. While climate change, Europe's changing demand for ivory, and the arrival of the Inuit were beyond their control, how the Norse dealt with those changes was up to them. Their impact on the landscape was a factor entirely of their own making. We shall see how the shifts in those advantages and the Norse reactions to them combined to bring an end to the Norse Greenland colony.